Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle's weekly design show with me, Hugo MacDonald. Now, it's a common misconception that design is all about who can make the best chair. But design is about making things better in all walks of life. There's a growing appreciation from many sectors that design can improve the way they function and not just the way they look. In this week's show, we're looking at design and healthcare, visiting and hearing from the people and projects that understand the power of design to transform some of life's more unpleasant experiences. Coming up in the show, we speak to the people behind Maggie's Cancer Care Centres in the UK to find out why they use some of the world's leading architects to build their hospices.
As she described it, the strip lights were enough to kill you off. It wasn't the waiting that was the problem, it's how you waited and what you did with that waiting.
We head to Calgary to hear how one man is redesigning the wheelchair.
Everybody wants something different because every injury is slightly different and everyone's lifestyle is slightly different. So, you know, 14 years later, we have the most adjustable chair in the world.
And we sit down with Sean Hughes, Chief Design Officer at Philips, to discover how lighting can be used to speed recovery time in hospitals.
We have these animations on the wall, which is a whale swimming under the sea. And when the whale swims under the sea, the child is told to hold their breath as long as the whale. And that means they lie still for the procedure. So you've engaged them in storytelling and they've actually done what you want them to do. They're more and more compliant. And we can see that if they're more compliant, the procedure gets done more quickly, so the hospital gets a benefit.
All that, plus we visit Paul Priestman's studio to hear how hospitals can take cues from air travel. We drop in on French designer Mathieu Le Hanneur to hear about his lighting hospice. And I sit down with Christine Astorino of Fathom Design in Pittsburgh to hear about their strategic work in the US healthcare sector. That's all to come on this week's Section D here on Monocle 24. Our first story takes us to Calgary, Alberta, where a young man is revolutionising the wheelchair. Christian Bagg is the co-founder of Icon Wheelchairs, the most adjustable chair on the market. A machinist by trade, Christian has been making wheelchairs in his basement studio ever since an accident left him disabled 15 years ago. Our reporter, Karen Moxley, paid a visit to Christian's basement machine shop to hear about his work.
As a machinist, you work generally with metal on like a lathe or a milling machine. My name is Christian Bagg, and I am the co-founder of Icon Wheelchairs.
The entire basement of Christian Bagg's Calgary bungalow is a full-fledged machine shop, outfitted with every imaginable tool to cut and fashion metal. Christian is a second-generation machinist and a former semi-pro mountain biker and snowboarder. Christian's been in a wheelchair for 15 years.
Before I broke my back, I wanted to make mountain bikes. And after I broke my back, it seemed obvious to not make mountain bikes anymore and to make chairs. I broke my back in 1996 snowboarding in a big air competition, and I landed the wrong end up. That day used to be fresh in my mind, but I've been in a chair for 15 years, and it's really like a lifetime ago. It's kind of like just telling an old story. It's not like you're going back and it's tough to talk about. It's just like, it's a totally different life. So yeah, this one, you just put the metal in the vise and the cutting tool spins. And
after his accident, Christian got busy designing and building wheelchairs.
What made you want to start designing wheelchairs?
It was a total necessity thing. I'm 6'4", and when I broke my back, chairs were all the same height. I was sitting way too low and my knees were up around my ears, and the chairs were really crappy. They, like, just how they were built, since I was a machinist and I knew how things should be built, I just basically had to make one so that it would fit. So I just started making them for me, and then other people in chairs would see and they'd ask for something specific to them, and I thought, you know, this is a great, maybe I can make some money at this, I can have a little business. And that's when I realized that everybody wants something different because every injury is slightly different and everyone's lifestyle is slightly different. So, you know, 14 years later, we have the most adjustable chair in the world.
Height, width, seat depth, wheel spacing, backrest angle, the entire chair is customizable and easy to adjust, not to mention it's got built-in suspension. With all the extra bells and whistles, you might expect the chair to be heavy, but it weighs in at just under 21 pounds. And the cost, $4,300, is right on par with your average ultralight rigid chair.
It's amazing to people in the wheelchair world because what they've had available is so terrible for so long. But to the able-bodied population, you know, you tell them it's a seat that goes up and down, forward and back, the seat angle changes, the backrest angle changes, and it does essentially what every office chair does. You know, like, this isn't magic. We just tried. We tried a little bit. And we'll, so long as we continue to try, it'll get better. But it really shows, I think, how far behind the rest of the industry is.
The idea behind this chair seems so simple, but why hasn't it been tried before? Christian says it's because the wheelchair market is dominated by a small number of manufacturers, and they've got a pretty captive audience.
Year after year, those companies make their same market share. There's some business guy looking at a spreadsheet, and if that little line doesn't drop below a certain point, why would you put a dollar into making it better? That's what I truly believe. And so they haven't put a dollar into making it better. No one chooses between, you know, are we going to go on vacation this year? Or are we going to get a new wheelchair? If you need a wheelchair, you need a wheelchair. There's no getting around it. No one's made a change because they haven't had to.
What is this?
This is going to be a seat for my chair. In some ways, that's how we get new stuff, is I make it for myself, and if it works well, then it gets passed down the line to everybody.
You're the guinea pig.
Yeah, well, and I'll always be the guinea pig. I'm completely reliant on technology. There's no way around it. I can't lie to myself and say that I'm not. So from skiing to biking to getting around all day, every day, I'm reliant on a seat with wheels on it. And so I'm going to make that the best seat with wheels on it I can. And it just so happens that we saw an opportunity to give that to everybody else. This is the best wheelchair on the planet. And it's not because, like, I'm really close to it and, like, I really want it to be. It's that it is. And everybody who sees it and everybody who tries it is amazed by it.
Is this one of the chairs?
This is a chair I just made for me.
Right. So
it hasn't been easy getting the wheelchair onto the market. Christian's business partner is Jeff Adams. He's a gold medal Paralympian, and he's also in a wheelchair himself. On the long road to producing the Icon chair, the duo first partnered with a big medical company and then a high-end bike company. Jeff and Christian even went on an entrepreneurial television show here in Canada called Dragon's Den. Those ventures didn't work out, but now they've teamed up with the mega manufacturer, Multimatic.
A big difference between us and any other wheelchair company, too, is our connection with Multimatic. So it's not just a well-designed chair, it's a really well-engineered chair. I'm super excited about the future because now it's not just Jeff and I and my family and his family and friends thinking about how to make this chair better. It's 15 of the smartest engineers I've ever met going home and being really excited about what they can do to help all these people. It's really contagious, the feeling you get.
The chairs have only been on the market for 3 weeks, but orders are pouring in and feedback is overwhelmingly positive. But here in his basement workshop, Christian says there is one thing that won't change.
Let's say the company's wildly successful and we make a ton of money and life is good. I'll still be down here designing and making new stuff because no amount of money changes my situation than that I'm in a chair.
In Calgary, for Monocle, I'm Karen Moxley.
Priestman Good, the London strategic design agency, has made its name designing interiors for some of the world's better business and first-class airlines. Prompted by the need for a more efficient, better operating design for hospitals in the UK, the firm set about using its experience to develop a new manifesto for the healthcare sector. Monocle's senior editor, Sophie Grove, sat down with Paul Priestman to hear about the Priestman Good Recovery Lounge.
Paul, I wanted to start by asking you what the challenges of designing healthcare really are.
The challenges of health design are obviously to do with cleaning, maintenance, and also making someone feel better in a hospital environment, I think.
And how has your company sort of gone about creating these environments? I mean, how do you, if you get commissioned to do, you know, a hospital or a clinic, where do you draw your inspiration from?
Well, we've always used our understandings of other industries and applied it to new industries. And we do an awful lot of aircraft design, the interiors and seating. And from that area, we started to think about the similarities between designing for the very rigorous aviation industry and applying that to hospitals.
And are there similarities?
There are many similarities. When you're designing for an aircraft, if something becomes damaged, then the aircraft might not be able to take off. So design is absolutely critical that it has to work. And it's the same in a hospital environment. Maintenance is obviously a big issue. An aircraft, when it lands, has to be turned around very quickly, cleaned. And that's exactly what has to happen in a hospital, but in a very, very precise way, because obviously germs and bugs are a big issue in hospitals.
And it's a kind of utilitarian principle that you've just spoken about, but how do you deal with the aesthetics of that, especially in healthcare?
If someone feels better when they're in hospital, they're going to get better more quickly, is my view. And I just think some of the hospitals I've been into are just dire. And they're just like from another era. It's almost like some of those early Carry On films, and they just haven't really moved on.
Do you think that we're in many societies we're sort of stuck in the Victorian concept of a hospital? Can you point out any hospitals that you think are really leading the way on this?
Yeah, there's the new Bath Hospital, which I think is really interesting, and they're beginning to break the moulds a little bit. And some of the hospitals I've seen in Australia, I think they're leading the way. But unfortunately, I suppose the national health here in the UK has a long history, and has a lot of quite old elderly buildings. But I think that's beginning to change.
And do you think that healthcare professionals understand the importance of design, or have you come up against some sort of institutional barriers as a designer?
I think that one of the big issues in the healthcare, as we understand it, is procurement, and this constant having to drive down price, which does stifle innovation, and it really is not able to look at the bigger picture. I mean, for instance, we were working on a project to look at bedside tables. And during the research and the development of this product, it proved that if people drank more water, they would get out of the hospital more quickly because they would get better more quickly. But one of the barriers with that is that a jug of old stale water next to you isn't very inspiring to drink. So we suggested perhaps having a refrigerator or a different way of supplying water. It would have been more expensive, but in the end, it would have driven costs down overall. But because of the procurement system, it doesn't allow that sort of global view of the whole process.
And tell me about your manifesto. I've been reading fascinating sort of tenets for designing in the healthcare arena. Can you give me a few snippets of the kind of philosophy of this company?
Yeah, I mean, the health manifesto that we produced was really trying to look at different ways of thinking about the design of hospitals right from the beginning, the building of the hospital. And we related back to some of the work that we've been doing in the aviation industry. And if you imagine when designing for an aircraft, you're trying to create small private spaces in a public space, in effect. And we thought, well, that's very similar to a hospital environment. And particularly when you're looking at the way that the operations are now happening within hospitals, that you're not perhaps staying for a few days overnight in a hospital, but you're having an operation during the day and you're out before the end of the day. So at the moment, there just seems to be either you're placed in a ward, which is going back, as far as I can see, about 60 years, it hasn't really changed, or you're put in your own room, if you're fortunate enough to be able to do that. So we thought that why didn't we readdress the way that the buildings are created to save cost and to create these very carefully designed and easy to maintain bays that people can rest in after small operations. Hygiene is just absolutely number one. And again, through careful design, obviously you don't want gaps and cracks that you can't clean in, and you just have to think about the process. And I think through careful design, then we can eliminate the bugs and diseases, which unfortunately do are very prominent in hospitals.
It's quite difficult when you're talking about this kind of medicinal concepts to really think about ambience. And do you think that's one of your tasks, sort of merging the two?
Yeah, I mean, I think making people feel better, you know, just environmentally feeling better. So, you know, why are the lighting so dreadful in hospitals? You know, why are the, you know, there is no excuse not to have beautiful things on the walls and that moving away from the sort of that hospital environment into something to make you feel better. And particularly, I mean, with our concept, we certainly took the reference from spa rather than hospital. And with spas, you get really lovely references like ceramics and green and views and windows, and that's what we try to do. So when you're recuperating from a minor operation, for instance, you want to feel good and you want to be able to take your mind off things, but also you want to feel that people are looking after you.
That was Monocle's senior editor, Sophie Grove, with Paul Priestman in Priestman Goods London headquarters. Next up, we're off to Paris to talk life, death and lighting with Mathieu Le Hanneur. Stay tuned.
Every Monday, Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, casts a keen eye across the week's cultural events, taking in cinema, art, music, media, literature, and some of the world's more exclusive events. That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time and available on our Timeshift player and on iTunes.
Welcome back to Section D on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Parisian designer Mathieu Le Hanneur describes the remit of his work as designing therapeutic objects. His mission is to improve the relationship between the body and its environment, the living and the scientific. One of his latest designs is a light that monitors weather and health, designed for the palliative care unit of Croix Saint-Simon Hospital in Paris. We sent our reporter, Alexander Orne, to his studio to find out more.
You have worked on conceptual light for hospitals with your project Tomorrow is Another Day, an installation that reflects on the impermanence of things. The project was originally conceived for the palliative care unit at Diaconèse Croix Saint-Simon Hospital Group in Paris. Can you tell me more about this project?
It is an amazing commission because I've been contacted by the head of the service of the units of palliative care, and he asked me to design something, an installation, a design piece for the service. It was impossible for him to explain me at the beginning of the brief if he wanted this piece for the nurses or for the patients or for the family of the patients. And at the end, he told me he wanted a piece for all those persons. His idea was to try to improve, to make the relationship more easy, more clear between all those persons. And even if it was important to take in account the strong context of the palliative care, his idea was to find a way to bring life into this service. The main problem is not necessarily the angoisse, the stress of the patient, but more the relationship between the family and the patient themselves. Because it's very difficult, as you can imagine, to discuss with someone who's going to die in 1 week or maybe 10 days. So I wanted to find a way to help the discussion, to help to start the discussion. I guess in the whole world, the most easy discussion we can find is to talking about the weather. So I wanted to bring the weather and to bring the sky into the room, like a new window. But this window is not connected to the real sky at the real time, but to the sky of tomorrow. This is a way for me to be stronger than the death, because you never know when the death will arrive, but you always know what tomorrow will be, even if you will not be able to see tomorrow.
And how do you go about with a project like this? What do you think is important?
It's been a long time for me to find a way to know what I wanted to create for this unit. It's a big challenge for designers to design probably the last object those kind of person will see in the life. The piece is, this device is connected in real time to many different websites, and they bring all the weather information coming from all those websites. And a computer and a software will mix all this information and will create in real time an animation. And the vision and the image of the sky is displayed by an LED screen. And to avoid the sensation of a 2D screen like your computer or like your television, I put just in front of the screen a Onicom transparent plastic. This Onicom transparent plastic will transform this flat image into a kind of atmospheric image. The idea of this piece is not like a weather station when you want the truth of the weather that will be tomorrow. But the idea is more to give the mood and the sensation, the feeling of tomorrow and of the sky that will never stop. And in your life, you was integrated in these times and this is the end of yours. But you feel the world will continue. It's something that can be sad, but I guess and I hope the feeling was something more quiet, more maybe relaxing. I hope so.
Were there any challenges?
I haven't tried on the patient themselves. Today, the piece is displayed in a design gallery, and we are at this step of the project looking for money to install in the room. So my first wish and my first challenge is to improve this strong and, of course, difficult moment.
In what do you think design can be therapeutical?
From my very early project and my diploma project, for example, that was a project on the design of the medicine, I strongly think that a design can be and have to be a question of life and death and a question of a therapeutic approach. For me, a designer is a kind of doctor. And even you have to design some lamps, some chairs, some other stuff, and for medicine for sure. But for me, the designer is a kind of a super doctor because the designer is able to make diagnosis, is able to prescribe a medicine and to design this medicine. His goal and his job is not to create one more object, one more product, but to finding where is the problem and to finding a way to improve a situation and or to bring remedies to this problem or situation. In this therapeutic approach, I can show you a project that is not displayed in a palliative care unit, but here in my home and in many homes, because this is an industrial product and currently on the market since 1 year. This object, this project is air filter that improve our air quality to take off in the air all the chemical components, all the interior pollution and all kind of those toxic gas that we are breathing all day long. And the idea of this project is to improve the efficiency of the plant in this job. If I take off this bottom part, you can see the plant. You have to know that the efficiency of the plant in order to absorb the interior pollution is not based in the leaves of the plants, but more in the roots and in the soil. So this idea of this project is to bring this plant, this natural plant, inside this product and to force by a fan system, to force the interior air to be in contact at the right place at the right time. And by this way, the plants will continuously absorb this chemical components.
What would you like to do next?
I just finished to install a piece I made 1 year ago for an hotel in France. And this piece is a kind of a therapeutic piece because it's a bed that will improve your sleep. And this bed will help you to go faster and deeper into your sleep. But probably I would like to create a kind of blend between an hotel and an hospital to try to find a way to work on a large view of wellness and not only your comfort, but in this vision of the wellness where your psychology, when your physiology, when your relationship and your comfort for sure, a place where everything is connected to be at the end more connected to yourself and to what you really need.
That was Monocle reporter Alexander Orn in the Paris studio of Mathieu Le Hunner. Now, you might associate Dutch firm Philips with electronics or lighting, but the design agency is also a global leader in the field of medical equipment and the research and development of environments across all sectors. dedicated to improving the quality of human experience, we sent our reporter Daniel Giacopelli to hear from Sean Hughes, Philips' chief design officer, about their work in the healthcare sector.
Philips has probably been almost as long in the healthcare business as it has been in the consumer products business. We started as a company making light bulbs, and the step from light bulbs to x-rays is just a matter of wavelength. So actually, you know, we've been in and around the healthcare space for a very long time. And now healthcare is one of the sort of key divisions of the company. And our healthcare business spans a very broad spectrum of different types of healthcare industries. So we've got what you call the clinical healthcare, so equipment that is helping in a hospital environment to capture patient images or to monitor people when they're in intensive care units, as well as we have a home healthcare group, which is really looking after people with their solutions in the non-clinical environment. So, you know, we work from the hospital to the home in terms of delivering healthcare as a Philips group.
Explain the design process. How important is design?
If you think about design in the consumer product sense, then you're really designing for very emotional drivers. You're talking about things like fashion, does it fit in with my home, is it aspirational? You know, it's really about the aesthetic qualities. Whereas if you think about the healthcare environment, it's actually a little bit more of a functional driver in that you're trying to, will it work around a very specific solution? The products have to work both for a patient, so they have to be comfortable for a patient to experience, but they also have to fit into the workflow of the hospital environment and deliver a clinical result.
How big is the healthcare design team?
We're about 80 designers spread around the world, from Seattle to Shanghai and key cities in between. Then we have design presence in nearly all of those locations. So we're across three continents, North America, Europe, and Asia.
And the user experience.
Yeah.
You have a research lab. How do you determine what users want?
In the world of healthcare, then, if I think about our ambient experience, that really started with us saying, hey, we're designing this nice piece of MR or X-ray equipment, and we were focusing on the equipment. But then we thought, hang on, if we're going to be really successful, we better think about the room the equipment goes in and the process that the patient and the doctors would experience. So we extended the design problem from just the hardware to actually the built environment and the process flow. In healthcare design, we really are now looking not just from the hardware perspective, but from what we call an experience perspective. And if you think about an experience is something that happens over time. So it's not in a moment. So the one key thing that we do is we map the total experience of the patient over time and look at where can we improve the interactions with our equipment, with the hospital, from the car park to the exam room and back again is the sort of the thing that we're trying to design now.
And what kind of specific techniques do you use to make users feel more comfortable?
Well, one thing that we've seen that we're now getting evidence is actually sort of working quite well is this idea of what we call positive distraction. And we use that quite successfully with pediatric healthcare design. So when we developed an MR solution for a pediatric environment, we latched onto this idea of telling a story to children to distract them from the fact they're having the experience. It's this idea of a narrative. So we have these animations on the wall, which is a whale swimming under the sea. And when the whale swims under the sea, the child is told to hold their breath as long as the whale. And that means they lie still for the procedure. So you've engaged them in storytelling and they've actually done what you want them to do. They're more compliant. And we can see that if they're more compliant, the procedure gets done more quickly, so the hospital gets a benefit. So by defining the design experience in a different way, we've actually created a whole unique way of delivering the image capture process.
And explain the role of lighting. How important is lighting?
Lighting is very much an emotional trigger. You know your natural rhythms of your body are driven by the light. And by using light, we can create different emotional experiences. So we use the idea of light and the flexibility of light so patients can choose their own experience.
And you find it's very effective with children?
The combination of the storytelling, the animation, and the light, and also we developed this other product called the Kitten Scanner, where actually we had a mini scanner and a sort of a teddy bear, and we explained to the child in terms they would understand that, look, the teddy bear is going to go into the scanner, i.e. you are going to go into the scanner in a few moments. The teddy bear is going to go into the scanner, we press a button, and we see a picture of the teddy bear. And if the teddy bear lies still, then the picture isn't blurred. And the child then practices it, so when they go into the exam room, they've actually experienced it themselves, and now they will be much more compliant.
And what's the Healing Environment Lab?
So the Healing Environment Lab is a new venture that we've set up in our research labs in Eindhoven, where we are saying, having looked at ambient experience and taught about the spaces where we capture images, now could we take the same techniques and the same thinking and thinking about the patient rooms? So what could we do as designers and interior designers and architects within that space to help the space contribute to the healing process? We start a series of experiments to answer those questions so that we can then come with a proposition to say to hospitals and clinics, hey, we've got something that really works for you. But you have to have a hypothesis first. And this is what our healing environments is about, is to test a few of our hypotheses.
So you have healthcare professionals and psychologists working in the lab? Or
in Philips Research, we have a whole range of different capabilities within Philips Research, but also within Philips Design. I'm responsible for Philips Design, and there we bring architectural capabilities, interior design capabilities, people research capabilities, so asking the right questions, talking to the patients, how did they experience it, talking to professionals, what are they doing. So yeah, we bring that variety of disciplines into that healing lab, complemented by our colleagues in Philips Research, who have got a lot of technical capabilities, and we bring those skills together to create this healing environment lab.
And what about some future concepts?
Whenever people ask me about the future of healthcare, then the obvious things that we could say that will impact the future of healthcare are things like sort of telemedicine. So the idea that you can remotely connect people to the healthcare system, people maybe can more remotely connect to their doctors or experts around the world. That for sure will continue. I think the idea that the computing platforms are getting smaller, so you think about tablets and smartphones as handheld computing platforms, they're going to enable us to deliver healthcare in different ways that we don't know yet. They've not been invented, but the fact is you've got a computer in your pocket that can help you connect, review, comment, engage other people in is quite important. I think there's a massive efficiency drive. If you think about governments and hospital authorities around the world want to do more and better with less money, so there's enormous economic issues there. And then you have sort of the impact of the aging population in certain countries. Look at Japan and its demographic. So how are we going to deal with more people living longer, needing more care?
Is there some resistance from hospitals to kind of accept these innovative ideas?
I wouldn't say resistance. What I would say is there's a healthy sort of degree of prudence, right? Because it's an environment where you don't want to take a risk. You want to be sure that what you're doing really works, because if you design something that fails, the consequence of failure in this domain is quite severe, right? Somebody could be really affected by a badly designed piece of healthcare equipment. It's maybe slightly different than in some other categories. So you have to be sure. Healthcare is also learning by doing, yeah? A lot of the times it's about trying something and experimenting and finding out what happens, and then building on that knowledge as you go.
That was Monocle's Daniel Giacopelli with Sean Hughes, Philips Chief Design Officer. We're off for a quick break, but stay with us. Next up, we'll be hearing why one small charity employs some of the world's greatest architects to build its hospices.
For listeners in Tokyo or visitors to Japan, you can now enjoy a coffee, a Wilkinson dry ginger ale, or our classic curry at our first ever Monocle cafe and shop at the new Hankyu Men's Department Store, just steps from Ginza and the lobby of the peninsula. Featuring a Monocle shop stocked with our ever-expanding collection of special collaborations, the Monocle cafe is the perfect place to refuel after a run round the Imperial Palace or a busy day in Marunouchi. For more details, visit monocle.com.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Now, hospitals and hospices, by virtue of their function, are fairly grim places. But do they really need to be? And in fact, doesn't it make far more sense to plug creativity into buildings where environment and well-being are more crucial than ever to the people who use them? Maggie's Cancer Centres, a UK-based charity that has established and run a series of hospices for those suffering from cancer, has pioneered this very principle. Our reporter, Lolita Laguna, visited the wonderful people at Maggie's to hear more.
This lovely sort of alley in orange that takes you from the hospital car park and away from the main road into this little oasis with long grass and trees. You can still hear the outside, but there you go, you're on the main road.
My name's Adam Hollier. I'm a media coordinator for Maggie's. And we are at Maggie's Centre in London, in the grounds of Charing Cross Hospital. It's coming in.
My name is Laura Lee and I'm Chief Executive of Maggie's. Maggie's are places on hospital grounds adjacent to cancer centres where people who are going through cancer diagnosis and their family and friends can come to for the emotional and psychological and informational and sort of practical support that can help them get through what is really a very tough time in their life. So Maggie Keswick-Jenks was married to Charles Jenks, who I think is well known as a sort of architectural critic, writer and designer. And he met Maggie when she was an architectural student at the AA. I got to know Maggie and Charlie when they came to the Western General Hospital when Maggie was diagnosed with a recurrence of her breast cancer, and she sat for many, many hours in very gloomy hospital waiting areas where the, as she described it, the strip lights were enough to kill you off. It wasn't the waiting that was the problem, it's how you waited and what you did with that waiting. And so really it was through her own personal cancer experience and her knowledge and insight about what architecture and environment and light and views could do that really led to this miraculous first centre in Edinburgh and then the others subsequent that followed.
It's all very open, lots of glass, yeah, to be able to look out and reflective of trees and plants and foliage.
And lovely in the summer, you get the fantastic, all the triangular beams of light.
You know, we're certainly not just building fancy buildings for the sake of it. We're building buildings because they can actually help us do our job. And that comes from lots of levels. Because the buildings are surprising and unique, people know actually that's the place to go to for cancer support. Because they're intriguing and curious making, people say actually it's not something to be ashamed of, getting cancer. Because you come in and the buildings are uplifting and inspiring, actually it's saying I'm still valued and I still matter. And then because some of them are a little bit odd and quirky, people come in and are sort of distracted by the architecture that actually, as they're led over to the kitchen and the kettle, actually start to tell you about how they're feeling without realising that they were going to do it. So the architecture actually facilitates communication, and our job of helping people deal with the biggest existential crisis that they may have gone through in their life, the architecture actually helps them to start to express and explore that crisis.
Nice and quiet, so yeah. You come here if you just want a bit of space, perhaps just want a minute for a cry, or just to get yourself together.
Do you think good design is a kind of complementary medicine for people who are going through a difficult diagnosis?
We know that the environment influences our thoughts and processes and reactions, so it's not rocket science to assume that actually if you think about the environment within which you want to enhance communication and dialogue and support, that the environment must play a role in that. And I can only give you my personal experience of, I was a cancer nurse working in that clinical area that Maggie had this experience. I moved over into that building and the first few days as the doors opened, it was the same patients that I had seen in the hospital. And I wasn't any different as a health professional, but they told me stuff about their lives, the things that they were finding difficult, that the challenges that they were up against. And so for me, the logical conclusion was that the building and the environment had to be the thing that gave them the confidence and the safety and the security to go there with that conversation. So I've become a personal convert through my own experience.
But as you can see through here, lovely courtyard area. So we've got a sort of another kitchen table. And in the summer, it's lovely, the big glass doors open up and people spill out and sit out in the sunshine there. And that becomes the kitchen.
I'm called Piers Goff. I'm a partner of CZWG Architects, and we are the architects for the Maggie Centre in Nottingham.
Can you tell me about the reputation that Maggie's has within the architectural world?
Oh, sort of, it's like the sort of angelic reputation, I suppose, in the architecture world, because they commission really interesting architects. I mean, not me, but other architects are famous international architects. And then they give them really a pretty free hand. They give them a brief, but they give them a free hand to do, to interpret the brief how they will. And so in that way, they are thought of as perhaps one of the most wonderful kind of clients. They know what they want. On the other hand, they're perfectly prepared for you to tell them what they're going to get, which takes a lot of nerve and a lot of confidence, both in themselves and in the architect.
And there we go, the home is where the fire is. So this is a lovely, very, very peaceful, very quiet, very homely.
Coming out there, a gas fire, obviously, and warm and comforting, and these cushions, all of the cushions, just, you know, they are begging for you to just sink down into them.
I think you're right, and all the chairs are really comfy.
The site was chosen in deference, really, to the being on a hospital grounds where the hospital might need other bits of the site, i.e. they are patently going to renew, expand, change. So our site is tree-lined, but also hilly, in a way that, again, a hospital probably would think twice about building on this site because it's a very steep hill. We thought it was a lovely way of lifting people above the general level.
And can you go over the structure? Because it's very striking.
Yes, we put it up on a base. The building appears to float above the ground. It looks a little bit like one of those dream houses of the 60s. And I'm a very 60s kind of boy, really. The outside of the building reflects that with four intersecting oval elevations. And when I say intersecting, they overlap at the corners like a Canadian log cabin is how I'd describe it. The logs kind of cross over each other, and that's really what happens here. To get that total oval, to get the whole of the oval, each of those walls crosses over the other wall. And so red on elevation, it's a pure oval, but it's got the wings of the cross elevations coming through it. The use is near domestic. It's supposed to be a pretty strong contrast with the antiseptic and institutional feeling of a major hospital. It's very hard for a hospital to look charming, but this building is an antidote to that. It's supposed to look utterly charming and completely sort of seductively warm, pleasant, and comforting. The outside is perhaps, by being bright green, it is quite a statement, but the inside is like a sort of super house rather than an institution.
It's certainly not an institution.
Not at all. This does not feel like a hospital. No. It doesn't feel like a hospital.
I'm Lily Jenks. I'm a landscape architect and an architect assistant. And I've been working with Maggie's since its inception because my mother was Maggie Jenks, who wrote the blueprint for Maggie Centres. So this is the garden design for Gart Naval, which is the second Maggie Centre in Glasgow. And the building is designed by Rem Koolhaas at OMA and his team. And I started actually working in his office for him on the building design, and then later was asked to do the landscape, which is, it's a courtyard building, so it's both the internal courtyard and the surrounding landscape. The building itself is glass and concrete, and that's more or less it, and wood on the roof, beautiful wooden roof. And the landscape really is the kind of yin to the yang of the building. It kind of softens it and gives it some light and movement. Both of them together, they were conceived very much together. It was the outside coming in and then the experience of the inside looking out. Design is very important, and Maggie's have been wonderful to really use that as their way of approaching a different kind of care. And I think it's part of it is about the individual and that kind of appreciation of that you're not a number in a big institution, but that you're an individual, and how you feel and what your experience of a space is matters. I think the landscape, in a way, comes into this category of a place and something to reflect on and something to spend time looking at. I think that very importantly for Maggie's, it's the context and the environment around both the building and the individual. So that idea that nothing is in isolation, that everything is connected, and you need to consider the environment and the context.
And this whole place, it just exudes calm and peace.
Yeah. There is a strange magic in these centres.
I think Maggie centres really have to kind of give you a sense of
that you need to keep pushing. You really want to keep living because, God, life is good and there's great things going on and we really need to, really want to stick around and appreciate this. And that kind of will to live and joy of life is very much part of it.
That was our reporter, Lalita Laguna, with Lily Jenks, Piers Gough and Laura Lee from Maggie's Cancer Care. Our next foray into the world of design and healthcare took us to Pittsburgh. Former architect Christine Astorino and her firm Fathom has a mission to rethink hospital and medical care facilities through a process of rigorous research and a team of architects, designers, engineers and neuroscientists. She spoke to me on the line about Fathom and their peculiar way of working.
So I actually have a background in landscape architecture, so I learned the value of the design process and solving problems through that methodology very, very early on, and the ability to apply that process to solve other types of problems as well has just been really exciting for me to see happen. But one of the things that left me somewhat unfulfilled and being landscape architecture and architecture was that I felt that there were many, many assumptions made on behalf of the designers into understanding truly what the user experience was all about and how to design directly for that. I felt like some of the designs, although they were very functional in nature and probably very aesthetic in most counts, sometimes missed the opportunity to truly connect on an emotional level with the end users.
This is a very interesting point. It's something that we talk about a lot at Monocle, about how, particularly in the world of architecture and interior design as well, to a certain extent, that so much today is designed without any real thought going into how people use and relate to and connect to spaces.
You know, that was really kind of the aha moment for me, thinking about maybe there's this niche here that I could start to pursue, having this foundation of design, but also being so interested in how that really wants to connect with people and end users, and this passion of connecting design with people, and didn't really realize that design research and design thinking existed roughly 10 years ago I first came up with the concept.
Yeah.
It was just something that seemed pretty natural as a way of solving problems. And so we started doing a project in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and we got to have the opportunity to dig really much more deeply into what the patients, parents, and staff were looking for ultimately in this children's hospital experience. So having the opportunity as designers to create this ideal experience as a patient, as a staff, as a parent, what is that ideal? And instead of sitting back as designers and saying, well, we know exactly what it feels like to be a sick child in a hospital or a staff that's overworked or a family member that's just terrified of what their child is facing, we said, you know, let's really figure this out. And what are their emotional needs? What are their emotional drivers? How can we start to really embrace them in a design that meets their needs, not only aesthetically, not only functionally, but emotionally as well?
And so was this just a system of research then, going in and speaking to people and observation, watching the way that people sort of reacted to space and environment and sort of solving problems from that point of view?
Hugo, it was very similar to that. We did a lot of ethnographic research, shadowing people in the current environment, doing a lot of in-depth one-on-one interviews that lasted roughly an hour and a half. We used metaphor, we used visual images to really probe kind of a little bit deeper into their subconscious, uncovering some of those things that maybe they just couldn't articulate if you asked them straight out, well, what would you like your patient room to look like, or how would you like to experience the space? It was more about how do you want this experience to help you feel? And then we would take those emotions and then start to think about how that starts to create a more concrete design. So we had them do a lot of collage building. We did a lot of group work, which we call discovery sessions, which go way beyond focus groups. Obviously took a huge amount of photos and with people using their environments, did a lot of benchmarking studies as well. And then out of all of that emotive research, we were able to generate color palettes, overarching themes. So, for example, what we've uncovered at Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh a while back, that the biggest theme that connected and how patients, parents, and staff wanted to experience this ideal hospital was one of transformation. So they all in some way wanted to feel like their lives were going to be transformed by this new healthcare environment. One really big insight that came from a lot of the collages that the patients built was this notion of color and how color really sets the atmosphere for a place. And what we learned through our ethnographic research is that a child's hospital experience doesn't start the minute they walk through the front door of the hospital, but it starts the minute they leave their home and they're on their way to the hospital. So we took color, and instead of just applying it vibrantly throughout the whole interior, but we applied it on the exterior. So the patients now feel that when they're driving to the hospital, it's a environment and a building that they relate to, they feel welcomed by. It starts to reduce their anxiety even before they arrive, and it's a place that they feel is theirs. And so it's been really, really fulfilling to see the impact that just getting to know them better and the value of design research up front in the design process can ultimately affect the healing process. Some of the other healthcare projects that we've worked on that have been really very interesting is we've worked a lot for the Veterans Administration here in the States, and a lot with their mental health patients and their domiciliary units, and how does a military veteran transition better into civilian life when you're dealing with a disability, and so designing better environments around that. All of our insights then actually led the VA to be convinced to create more of a campus-like setting. So we designed, helped create a design that was more of a campus-like setting with homes and front porches and sports courts where they could kind of work together as a community, have family over to visit for a cookout, understand how to live in a home, learn domestic skills, all of those different types of things where they felt like they were being treated like a real person.
Yeah.
Not just somebody with an illness that was just, let's hurry up and treat this. And
amazing to think that we ever really got to a situation where the hospitals were built like prisons, really, or in such clinical environments. I suppose it's in the UK, we talk about it being a hangover from sort of Victorian attitudes towards sort of illness as being something that very much needed to be locked away. And, you know, it's incredible to think how long it takes to sort of unlock it, get into a different mindset that is actually just common sense more than anything.
Absolutely. There's been a really great rising interest. We've done some work in the Middle East around this. So even, you know, globally, I think people are really seeing the value of understanding the emotional needs that exist in a healthcare environment and how much just curing those can help with physical health. It's a much more holistic view.
That was me speaking with Christine Astorino, founder of Fathom Strategic Design Agency in Pittsburgh. And I'm afraid that's all we've got time for this week on Section D. But fear not, we'll be back next Tuesday at 1900 London time to talk design and books, libraries and literature. Today's show was produced by Gillian Tobias, our editor was Dawn Trump, and our researchers were Taya Erdl and Hazel Pfeiffer. I'm Hugo MacDonald. We'll be playing you out with TMNT Mask by Calgary star Chad Van Galen.